From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, millions of dollars for improving roads near affluent new subdivisions and nothing for crumbling streets in older cities. How we're building a state we just can't afford to maintain. Plus, from changing team names to removing offensive images like a stained glass window in West Michigan.
It depicted one of our ancestors basically being clubbed by a white settler.
Michigan's native tribes creating social change by offering money to make it happen. We'll hear how it's working. And the struggle to save a rare butterfly from becoming extinct.
The Mitchell Satyr is sort of like the ecological canary in the coal mine. It is sort of the poster child for water quality.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the Native American Heritage Fund was set up a year ago to give money to projects that deepen ties between local communities and Michigan's Native American tribes. Later in the hour, we'll explore some of those projects, including changing mascot names and removing offensive imagery from public places. But first, let's talk road repairs, specifically the out-of-whack funding system that means $9.7 million is being poured into widening 1.3 miles of 23-mile road in Macomb County, while elsewhere in the county, there are 800 lane miles of roads in poor condition and no money to fix it. Chad Livengood dug into this for Crane's Detroit Business, and he's with us now. Chad, you live in Macomb County. What did you see driving around that led to this story?
Well, I drive 10-mile, 11-mile, 12-mile, 9-mile through the older suburbs of Macomb County. I live in one of those suburbs in St. Clair Shores, and I experience the jarring roads every day. And recently I was out on 23 Mile, and I saw that they were widening the road, and there's a lot of subdivision sprawl going out there. There's these higher density condo buildings being built out in farm fields. And it got me thinking about, well, what are we paying for this? And how much is this costing? Because I knew off the top of my head that Macomb County has 800 some odd miles of county roads alone that are rated in poor condition. And of course, we know there is a major road funding problem in the state where these counties cannot catch up with the cost that they are absorbing.
So we're talking about these outer ring suburban townships, that the places that used to be farm fields, and now we're seeing, like you say, condo developments, we're seeing subdivisions with big, expensive new homes, and a lot of old two-lane country roads.
Yeah, I mean, these are the areas that were sod farms and plant nurseries just, 20 years ago. And there's continued sprawl going on, even though we as a state, and specifically Southeast Michigan, really have stagnant population. We're still moving out into far-flung areas. This is going on in Canton still, it's going on in South Lyon, Brighton, even around Ann Arbor. But at the same time, we're not keeping up with the infrastructure that we have. And that's a sort of an important issue I don't think has been talked about or debated enough in the legislature and in county commissions and road commissions is in townships specifically. And this is a case where you have charter townships like Chesterfield and Macomb Township that are approving subdivisions and essentially just dumping the road cost and infrastructure cost onto the county, because townships under Michigan's road funding law don't get direct aid from the state to pay for the roads that they have the ability to add a lot of congestion to by adding 400 or 500 unit subdivisions. And so I'm kind of raising the question about, what is the long-term policy here specifically to sort of pay for all this infrastructure, especially since right now we don't seem to be able to catch up with all the stuff we already built.
Yeah. Now, you've talked about this with Macomb County Exec Mark Hackle. What is his take?
Well, he admits he's basically a political prisoner to townships that want to expand their tax base. And as the way I put it in my column was, Townsend's the one that spanned the tax base to have turned farm field into cul-de-sacs, and he's also a prisoner to housing developers who want to turn farm fields into cul-de-sacs. I mean, that's essentially the problem that's gone on for over a couple generations now in Macomb County. You have these suburbs that built out before, these townships like Clinton and Shelby that are pretty mature and more developed townships, and they did the same thing. They basically built out big subdivision networks and put the cost of the roads onto the county. And now you have these even newer ones like Washington and Macomb Township and Chesterfield that are just essentially repeating the same thing that happened a generation ago.
And meantime, for the older, less affluent cities, let's say Warren, Hazel Park, you do a good description in your story about what it's like driving along the mile roads in those cities.
Yeah, I mean, it's impassable in some places. I mean, there are some repairs going on right now. I just kind of crawled down 12 Mile in Warren just a little bit ago this afternoon. And, I mean, there was some work, but they can't seem to keep up. I mean, it was a lot of work last year. Remember when Mound Road was falling apart?
Mm-hmm.
Sterling Heights in Warren and the county had to scrape together just money anywhere they could find to do a temporary repaving of most sections of Mound Road from 696 up to Hall Road, even though they went out and got a quarter of $1 billion federal grant for a complete rebuild that they're going to turn around and do in the next couple of years. They just needed to repave some parts of that road because it was impassable. And this is showing up everywhere. I mean, Harper Avenue through St. Clair Stores in Roseville, I've been calling it the new mound because it's sort of it's really one of these old concrete roads that's just getting these big gaps and it's becoming sort of bucktooth driving surface basically. And this is this isn't unique to Macomb County. I mean, this is prevalent in Ingham County. There's parts of Washtenaw County that clearly have the same type of infrastructure. You drive through some Sin City streets in Ypsilanti or in Lansing, and you get this similar feeling that there's an infrastructure that's falling apart. And meanwhile, there's still this sprawl going on in Michigan, even though we don't really have the population to even show for it.
Because as you write in your piece, Chad Livengood, this is the public policy of Southeast Michigan transportation planning for the past half century since the Truman administration. Is there any interest in Lansing in correcting this situation?
There is some. Interestingly enough, Mike Shirky, a Senate Majority Leader, who's a businessman, he owns a tool and die manufacturing company in Jackson. He's been thinking about this in terms of a business case that if you're going to build new roads, you need to have money behind those roads to replace it, to maintain it. He thinks about it in the case of his own machines. And if he doesn't replace and update his own machines, he's out of business. And he's like, we're not doing that with roads. And he thinks that needs to be reconsidered. And so, we'll see if this becomes part of the debate. And right now, Cindy, they have a hard time to try to figure out where they're going to get all the money to fix the current infrastructure, much less think about long term. But that's what we really kind of need some people in Lansing to be thinking about long term. What is the public policy of Michigan, especially if we want to have growth?
Yeah, because the question, I guess, really is how do we back up development with a revenue stream to support it as you're building and in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I talked to a guy named Ken DeCoke who runs a long time nursery out on 23 Mile Road that's basically being surrounded by subdivisions, and it's basically just a matter of time before his family is probably going to sell their family farm, their three generation family farm, and he kind of put it sort of succinctly as the same in Macomb County that the township, the county, and the state fix the roads after the people arrive, not before they arrive.
Chad Livengood with Crane's Detroit Business. You never know what kind of story will occur as you're driving around noticing road repairs, where they're happening and where they're not happening. It is always great to talk with you, Chad Livengood. Thank you so very much.
Anytime. Thank you.
The boxes and the envelopes show up at your doorstep, packaged and shipped by Amazon. All you have to do is click and pay. But behind the scenes, there are thousands of people who make your order and delivery possible. And it's a world most of us never get to see. But on Friday, Amazon showed off one of its newest fulfillment centers, a large building near Detroit Metro Airport that can process tens of thousands of orders at a time. Michigan Radio's Dustin Dwyer was there.
I'm in Romulus, standing inside a massive Amazon fulfillment center. It is full of hundreds of robots, little orange things that roll around on the floor and carry yellow bins around. And Sean Westland is the general manager here, and he is leading the tour.
This facility is 855,000 square feet. You can fit 14 football fields in this facility.
And if you stack all the steel in this facility on end, it's higher than two Eiffel Towers. We have over 10 miles of conveyor.
This tour is not just a private tour for me. It's a whole big media event with lots of dignitaries. Senator Debbie Stabenow is here, Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, and Congresswoman Debbie Dingell, all here, all asking questions of how this place operates.
So how many folks do you have working at one time on the floor?
We have 300 or 400 associates at a time. 1,500 associates is where we're at right now with our headcount.
Amazon says it employs a total of 2,500 people in Michigan at various fulfillment centers, distribution centers. And those people who work for Amazon, make $15 an hour, and they get paid time off.
It takes a lot of great associates to make this operation run. They're the heartbeat of what we do in this operation. We absolutely, when I talk to them, I always talk about the associates and how they make this place home and make customer orders fulfilled every single day.
And we hear a lot about working conditions for the people who work here. How about the robots? What kind of working conditions are there for the robots? They get breaks? They get vacation time too?
Do the robots get breaks? No, we don't give robots breaks. Well, they get a downtime. I take that back. There's a downtime between shifts. They might get about an hour.
No $15 an hour?
No.
No vacation time for robots?
No.
All told across the state, Amazon says it has 16 facilities. And the dignitaries here, the politicians, all say they hope that this center can grow and that the jobs can grow as well. In Romulus, I'm Dustin Dwyer, Michigan Radio News.
Coming up, former female inmates at the Grand Traverse County Correctional Facility are claiming their basic hygiene needs were often ignored. Interlochen Public Radio has been investigating conditions at the jail. We'll have that after the break. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. In April, the administrator for the Grand Traverse County Jail resigned after allegations he'd had inappropriate relationships with former female inmates. We'll get back to that in a bit. But first, Interlochen Public Radio has been investigating conditions at that jail. More than a dozen former inmates say a handful of officers ignore their needs. They say it can take days, even weeks, to get basic items like soap, a toothbrush, feminine hygiene products. Morgan Springer reports.
Former female inmates in Grand Traverse County say they've waited for hours for pads when they were on their periods.
And you'll see them walk around and they got blood coming out the back of their pants.
That's Jennifer Honeysett. She went to jail last year after being caught driving with a suspended license and fleeing a police officer. When she bled through her pants, she says she would wash them in her jail cell sink and then dry them on the heater.
One, it's unhygienic. It's embarrassing. And it's almost like, okay, because we're criminals, so we don't get to have, you know, clean clothes.
I spoke to a half dozen former female inmates who described a similar experience. One woman, her name's Kelsey Butters, says an officer refused to get her pads and told her to just use a sack lunch bag to soak up the blood. Here's Honeysett again.
We are females. We cannot prevent this situation. We can't stop and say, hey, we're in jail. Let's not have a period.
Unfortunately, it's all too common.
Miriam Aukerman is a senior staff attorney at American Civil Liberties Union of Michigan.
It's something that we hear about in jails and prisons across the country and across Michigan, and it really goes to basic human dignity. Do we want women to have to beg to get a pad, or do we expect them to sit in bloody clothes?
Aukerman says these conditions are appalling and unconstitutional.
The courts are very clear, the Constitution is very clear, that jails are responsible for the hygiene needs of female inmates, just as they're responsible for the hygiene needs of male inmates.
Grand Traverse County Sheriff Tom Bensley says corrections officers do a good job in less than ideal conditions. He says the jail's overcrowded and poorly designed, and they have staffing shortages that result in too much overtime. When asked about complaints his officers are ignoring requests for pads, Bensley had this to say.
Depending on what kind of complaint it was and maybe the particular issue or severity, I may not know about that. Just because a lot of those things are handled at the jail, they don't get up the chain, so to speak, to me.
Just to state the obvious, I guess, if that were happening, is that appropriate behavior for a corrections officer?
Depending on the situation, depending on what occurred, I would have to say we would look into that, and it may or may not be appropriate. I don't know without specific facts.
Like it might be appropriate for somebody to not have access to pads for a long time? That's what I'm asking.
Okay. A long time. Is that an hour? Is that 2 days? Or is that a week?
A couple hours.
Mm-hmm. Depending on the situation, depending on what's going on in the jail, depending on the staffing, which unfortunately we have a staffing issue. We do the very best we can with what we have. Sometimes some things get overlooked.
Otherwise, Bensley mostly deferred to Captain Todd Ritter, who was the jail administrator until he resigned this spring.
Nobody should have to wait for something like that.
And if you have officers who are just ignoring those requests?
That's unacceptable.
IPR requested officer disciplinary records and inmate complaints. In 2017 and part of 2018, jail staff were disciplined for a range of things, from falling asleep on the job to failing to check on an inmate, resulting in suicide. There was nothing about ignoring requests for hygiene products. Here's Sheriff Bensley again.
You know, if we don't know something is happening, we can't deal with it.
But they did deal with it, even though they say no issues were found. They told IPR that after our initial interview, they began stocking feminine hygiene products in each jail cell. Now female inmates can help themselves as needed. Jennifer Honeysett is now on probation. She works at a restaurant in downtown Traverse City and is expecting her fifth child.
It's been really good. My relationship with my children is amazing right now.
Honeysett doesn't have great memories of her time at the jail, but she and every other inmate I spoke to say there are plenty of good corrections officers there, people who work hard, care about the inmates, and respond to requests for assistance. But they say a few bad apples are making life at the jail a lot more dismal and hopeless than it should be. For Stateside, I'm Morgan Springer.
And Morgan Springer is here with us now. And Morgan, since you started investigating, the jail administrator, Captain Todd Ritter, resigned in late April following allegations of inappropriate relationships with former female inmates. Tell us more about these.
Yeah, there are a number of allegations, and I'll go into them. But just so that you remember, at this point, these are just allegations. If proven, they do all violate jail policy, though. So here's one claim. A 7-year-long relationship with a former inmate. He apparently also met that same inmate in the basement of the Grand Traverse County Government Center and was physically intimate. And that was at the point when she was on parole. They also allegedly smoked marijuana together. With a different former inmate, the sheriff's office says Ritter rented a hotel room in Lansing and billed it to the jail. He also apparently showed favoritism to a number of female inmates while at the jail. And there are claims that he had sexually explicit photos on his government-issued cell phone.
What does Ritter say about these allegations?
What we know is that in a letter to the Grand Traverse County Sheriff, Tom Bensley, he said, look, I'm very sorry for letting you down, and he then resigned.
Hmm. And how did the sheriff's office respond?
Well, they did accept Ritter's resignation. That was in lieu of a termination. And otherwise, Sheriff Bensley says he was really surprised about the allegations.
Now, have there been any movement toward criminal charges?
When I talked to Bensley, he says they finished up their investigation. So now it went over to the county prosecutor's office, and she's actually asked Michigan State Police to investigate more and see if there are any criminal violations to pursue.
Okay. Morgan, is there any connection between former inmates complaining that their requests for basic hygiene items were ignored and this alleged behavior from Captain Ritter?
It's really hard to say. I did put that question to Sheriff Bensley. And what he said to me is, you know, he gets the thinking that the administrator or head of the jail sets the tone or could set the tone and the culture for the jail. But he says in this instance, he doesn't think that's the case. And if he were to say that, it would just be pure speculation.
Now, this investigation into Captain Todd Ritter started after the sheriff's office hired a new undersheriff last fall. And now Captain Ritter is out. He has resigned. Sheriffs are elected officials. When is the next election?
It's in 2020. Sheriffs in Michigan are up for re-election every 4 years. Sheriff Bensley runs as a Republican. He ran unopposed in 2016. 2012, he had two challengers, but he won with 60% of the vote, and he also ran unopposed in 2008.
So he's had a pretty clear path to re-election. Do we have a feeling whether he'll run for re-election in 2020?
So I asked him last fall, and he said he was initially planning not to run, but then because of all these changes in his office, he was considering it again. And then when I talked to him last week, he said he didn't want to comment with an update. So I can't really say where he's at this very moment.
Morgan, in your report, you said the jail staff changed how they distributed feminine hygiene products. Was that because of your reporting?
Here's what I can say. Former jail administrator, Captain Todd Ritter, who we've been talking about and heard about in this story, he told me that he made those changes after our initial interview with him last year. So as mentioned in the story, instead of distributing feminine hygiene products once daily as they had before, he says they now stock them in the jail cell. What I don't know is if this has made a significant difference for female inmates.
Morgan Springer, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
If you're looking to make a change in society, perhaps to fix a problem, you could write letters, make phone calls, demand change, or you could put up money to help make that change happen. And that's how the Native American Heritage Fund has been doing it, handing out grants throughout the state, supporting projects that can deepen ties between local communities and schools and Michigan's Native American tribes. Jamie Stuck is tribal chairperson of the Nottawaseppe Huron Band of the Potawatomi, which is the tribe that's behind this Native American Heritage Fund. And with us now, welcome to Stateside, Jamie.
Hello, how are we doing today?
Very well, very happy to have you with us. Tell us, how did this fund come to be, and what is the problem it's seeking to solve?
Well, when you're talking about issues that affect Native American communities all across the state of Michigan, not just ours, we really want to reach out to communities and create a positive, cooperative relationship with people. And sometimes barriers to that are costs. Some of these initiatives could include changing curricula that better represents Native American heritage and values, as well as their history. Anything as far as helping out with revising or replacing mascots or imagery that could be deemed as creating a negative environment for our Native American students, whether it be within universities, colleges, K-12 public, private schools, or even charter schools. So one of the barriers, as I stated, was maybe offsetting costs that allow these respectful relationships. And, you know, sometimes people are really good pointing out the issues. We want to be able to identify items that could create that better relationship between the sovereign nations of Michigan and non-Native communities. But we also want to be able to provide that solution as well.
So you see a problem and help point it out. But by the way, here's some money that we want to give to help come to a mutually respectful solution.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah. So every year, per our gaming compact with the state of Michigan, we have to provide a percentage of our revenue to the strategic fund, which helps provide funding for the economic development of the state of Michigan.
So the money is actually coming from gaming?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Turning right around and going back into the state.
Yep. So what we do is we provide that percentage to the state of Michigan for the strategic fund, which is underneath EDC. And then with that amendment to our state compact, it allows us to take $500,000 from the strategic fund and transfer it over to the Native American Heritage Fund. Now, we aren't able to cap out past $500,000, so it really is advantageous for us to spend it as we can. Whatever we carry over is capped off to $500,000, so the carryover doesn't really help us.
So the idea is, let's get this $500,000 out and being put to use. And I'm wondering, Jamie, do communities, do schools, do they approach you with an idea, or is this something where perhaps a tribe may identify a need and then approach the community or the school?
It's a process where people can apply, organizations, whether there be K through 12, public, private, charter schools, accredited colleges or universities, local governments, or even nonprofit organizations, just as long as they are partners with a sovereign nation of the state of Michigan.
So let's get an idea of what kinds of projects you've been working on with these Heritage Fund grants. I know one recipient of a grant was the school district of Belding. It's about 30 miles outside of Grand Rapids. And that was a pretty hefty grant, wasn't it?
Yes, ma'am. That grant paid in full for all the costs incurred for them changing their mascot. The cost of that equaled up to just about $377,000. There's just a lot of unknowns when it comes to changing mascot. It could be apparel, scoreboards, taking statues down, changing wood floors in the gymnasium, having to change your letterhead, stuff like that. And we wanted to make sure that we rewarded the Belding School District as far as the Native American Heritage Fund board members to help reimburse those costs in full.
So what was the name, and then what did they change it to?
I'll refer to it as the R word.
Okay, got it.
And they changed it to the Black Knights.
Okay. And I know that there, I want to talk with you about this stained glass window in the Battle Creek City Hall, and that prompted a $3,400 grant. Tell us about this window.
It depicted one of our ancestors basically being clubbed by a white settler. Oh. And it's their official city seal. But since then, they have, I believe, taken it down. And they are going to work with the tribe to come up with a seal that's better representative of our ancestors. So it's been a really good partnership there. So we did decide as a Native American Heritage Fund board to reimburse half of the cost for taking that medallion down. Mm. We also wanted the city of Battle Creek to have some skin in it, too. But again, that was, I don't want to say seamless because it took a lot of time and cooperation, but it was all positive, and the city of Battle Creek felt that it needed to be down as well.
Sure. And, you know, we just must have to stop and wonder how many more artifacts like that medallion could be out there that people, you know, they've seen it so long, they don't see it. They don't see it with new eyes.
Right. Yeah, and, you know, unfortunately, it could be a depiction of the history mm-hmm. as far as what our ancestors had to endure. But on that note, we also had the same positive outcome with the city of Kalamazoo, as I'm sure you're already aware. They had the pioneer statue in downtown Kalamazoo in Bronson Park. And again, it kind of portrayed an inferior relationship between a white settler and one of our ancestors. And actually, before the applications went out last year, they decided to take it down. Mm. By the time we reimbursed half the costs that were incurred for that, they had already made the decision and had the removal of the statue and fountain already. But the Native American Heritage Fund Board, we were more than happy to, you know, help out with half the cost of that as well.
Now, as you mentioned, you've just closed applications for the second year of running this fund. How do you think this fund has made a difference in Michigan?
Well, I think it's made a big difference with the different sovereign nations of the state of Michigan, knowing that the efforts there to try to help create that cooperative and respectful relationship between non-Native communities and the sovereign nation tribes of the state of Michigan. But, you know, just being in the second year, we can do better as far as getting the message across nationally, I think, just so that other states maybe can follow the process.
Is this fund unique? Is this the first fund of its kind in the country?
From what we're hearing, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's one of a kind, you know, and it has had a positive effect. And, you know, I've talked to other leaders at a national level. And I've actually had the opportunity to speak with the head of N7, which is the Native American shoe brand for Nike. And they seem pretty interested in the Native American Heritage Fund as far as how we're trying to create that positive relationship. So I hope to have further conversations with Nike as far as what we're trying to do to impact Native American communities and non-Native communities.
Indeed. So, and when do you plan to have decisions made on the second year's grants?
I really can't put a date on that one. We want to make sure that we're within the confines of the state compact, and we're making sure that those that are receiving funds from this Heritage Fund are eligible according to that.
Jamie Stuck is the Tribal Council Chairperson for the Nattawaseppe Huron Band of the Potawatomi and also chair of this Native American Heritage Fund board that we've been talking about. Jamie, thank you so much for sharing your work with us on Stateside.
Miigwech. That means thank you in our Potawatomi language.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Still to come, the Mitchell's Satyr is one of the world's rarest butterflies, found only in Indiana and Michigan.
With human development and urban encroachment, these habitats have become more and more fragmented, they've been modified, and they've been downright lost.
Can scientists save this rare butterfly from extinction? That's in 10 minutes, right here on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The race is on to save one of the world's rarest butterflies. You will only find the Mitchell's Satyr in Michigan and Indiana. So let's learn what's being done to save this butterfly from extinction as we say hello to Daria Hyde, who's a conservation scientist with the Michigan Natural Features Inventory at Michigan State University. Daria, good to have you with us. Describe this butterfly for us.
Oh, sure, Cynthia. At first glance, it might just look like a little brown butterfly bobbing around on top of the vegetation, but when you get a closer look, it's really quite lovely. It has a warm brownish hue, and when you look up more closely, there's about 4 or 5 eye spots on the bottom wing and a few eye spots on the underside of the top wing that are black, but they have a little iridescent silvery markings in the middle of the eye spot, and they're encircled in a golden color. And then all of those eye spots are encircled by some orange bands that are quite brilliant. So when you get a real close-up view, they're actually quite stunning.
And only found in Michigan and Indiana?
That's correct. There are certain species that are closely related. There's the St. Francis Satyr that's found in North Carolina. And then there are some similar species found in Mississippi and Alabama. But currently, genetic analysis, they're still trying to figure it out, but they don't believe that those are the exact same subspecies of butterfly. So we're still working that out with the geneticist.
Okay. And was the Mitchell's Satyr once upon a time living in a wider area? Did it have a wider habitat?
It did have a wider habitat, but it was never as common as, let's say, the monarch butterfly. It was once known from about 30 sites in Michigan, Ohio, Indiana, and New Jersey. But as recently as 1991, it was only found at 15 sites. And currently, we only know it from 10 sites in Michigan and 1 in Indiana. Ooh. But of those 10 sites in Michigan, only 6 of them are considered to be viable. The rest seem to be sputtering out. So it's been pretty discouraging.
As you're describing this, you don't even need to be good at math or graphing to just see, you know, this downtick as far as where you can find
yes.
it. So if you were to say, how endangered is this butterfly?
It's one of the most endangered butterflies in the world. The other species in Michigan that many listeners may have heard of is the Powashiek skipperling. This is even more rare than the Mitchell's Satyr, only known from 4 sites in Michigan and a couple of sites in Canada. But the Mitchell's Satyr globally is one of our most rarest butterflies.
And what happened to put it on this endangered list?
Well, its habitat is a very unique type of habitat. called a prairie fen. And prairie fens are a globally rare community. They're found in southern Michigan, set in a landscape of these depressions at the base of these glacial landforms where you've got cold groundwater kind of coming up under the pressure of these, you know, at the bottom of these hills, and this groundwater is bubbling up into these wetlands, and it creates conditions that are really appropriate for many unique plants and animals that depend on this calcium-rich groundwater. Mm. So these types of communities have never been that common, but what has happened is with human development and urban encroachment, these habitats have become more and more fragmented, they've been modified, and they've been downright lost. You know, whether it be the filling of wetlands or putting a road through one of these prairie fens or the depletion of this really important groundwater, it's just been one thing on top of another, and these habitats have become quite vulnerable.
And I went digging around, and I read on a state website that there's also a problem for these wetlands with this invasion by exotic plants that make that wetland unsuitable for poor little Mitchell's satyr, so they can't make it.
Exactly. And these invasive plants also harm the habitat for really beautiful orchids that occur in these wetlands. Hmm. There's also some very interesting carnivorous plants like sundews and pitcher plants, and a whole host of other really interesting plants and lots of other butterflies and tree crickets, birds, frogs, turtles, you name it. It's a very biologically rich community. I think one of the reasons that we're having a lot of invasive plants moving into these wetlands is it's actually twofold. One is as the groundwater becomes depleted, whether it be through pumping for irrigation or roads or ditches, as our groundwater gets depleted, the wetlands start to dry up, and then these invasive plants then have conditions that are more suitable and they can take over. And also, these wetlands used to have fires that would move through them occasionally. Native Americans used to set fires to manage the land, but now with so many, you know, human communities around these wetlands, fire has been more difficult to maintain, although some land conservancies are using prescribed fire to try and help manage these systems and prevent the invasive species from taking over.
You know, Daria, as you describe this, I'm envisioning this big Jenga game with all of these pieces fitting in,
yes,
and then you pull one out and things start to crumble.
That's exactly right. That's a really good characterization, Cynthia.
Am I also right that Mitchell's satyr adult butterflies, typically we should be seeing them soon, right? Flying between the third week of June to the third week of July?
That's exactly right. Yes. It used to be 4th of July was the peak of the flight, but with climate change, we're finding that it's flying a little bit earlier each year, although probably not this year. It's been a fairly cool spring.
Okay.
But the adults only fly for 3 to 4 weeks at most. They spend most of their life as a caterpillar.
Huh.
And the caterpillar is green, and it blends right in on the food plant that it eats, which is a narrow-leaf sedge. So it's very hard to find these caterpillars in a prairie fen. But the butterflies, if anyone wanted to see these butterflies, the Surette Nature Center right near Benton Harbor has a boardwalk that goes through a prairie fen, and the naturalist on staff there would be happy to show people this butterfly. You can walk on the boardwalk and you can see the butterflies just bobbing along on the tops of the sedges.
Oh, that sounds great.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
And what needs to happen to save the Mitchell's satyr? Can it be saved, and can it get out of the endangered category?
I think it's possible. I do have some hope. There's some very dedicated individuals working at federal agencies like the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, state agencies like the DNR and Eagle, the Nature Conservancy, many land conservancies. There's many people working together on a Mitchell Satyr working group. We've been working since 1998, actually, to develop conservation strategies to help save this butterfly. So folks are doing things such as habitat restoration, trying to protect the groundwater. And we do have people at the Toledo Zoo and Kalamazoo Nature Center that are actually rearing these butterflies in captivity. And so we've developed plans to actually rear the butterfly and then release them at sites that are more protected and that don't have as many threats. And so we're hopeful that if we can rear enough butterflies in the zoos and at the nature center, we can start establishing more populations and reverse this decline. So there are folks who are doing research and management and then doing the captive rearing, as well as trying to do outreach to policymakers and the public to try and see if we can stem the decline.
And what do we lose if the Mitchell's satyr butterfly vanishes?
You know, that's a really good question. And I think that the Mitchell satyr is sort of like the ecological canary in the coal mine. It is sort of the poster child for water quality. Because these wetlands are so dependent on clean, cold groundwater, when we start losing animals and plants from these systems, I think it's a real warning sign that then could eventually affect human beings. We depend so much on fresh, clean water, and some of the tragedies we've had in Michigan most recently around drinking water, I think, really bring this to the forefront. Loss of biodiversity weakens the web of life. You know, we're all interconnected. And the more you start breaking some of those strands of the web, then the system becomes more simplified. And simplified systems are less resilient. It can affect our lives. It can affect our cultural values, our recreational values. Can affect our food systems as we lose pollinators. That can affect the food that we eat. And then it just overall, you know, I would like my grandchildren to be able to see this beautiful butterfly. And it makes me sad to think that that may not be a given. So I'm working very hard alongside of many other dedicated professionals and private citizens to make sure that doesn't happen.
Working to save the Mitchell's satyr butterfly from extinction. Daria Hyde with Michigan State University with the Michigan Natural Features Inventory. Thank you for sharing your work and your passion with us.
Thank you very much.
The regular school year is wrapping up, and now the question becomes how to put the brakes on summer slide. That's when students come back to school in the fall, having forgotten things they learned the grade before. What to do? Well, summer school, but does it work? Catherine Augustine has done a lot of research into summer learning programs. She's a senior policy researcher for the RAND Corporation, where she directs the RAND Pittsburgh office. And we must note, she has earned degrees at both Michigan State and the University of Michigan. Catherine, welcome.
Thank you, Cynthia. Great to be here.
Why was it important for you to study summer learning programs to the depth that you've done?
There have been evaluations of summer programs, and they don't always demonstrate that the programs themselves are effective. And summer is, unfortunately, a time of unequal experiences and opportunities, and lower-income kiddos tend to fall further behind in the summer on various measures, academically, but also in terms of opportunities to participate in clubs and sports and what have you. And so it's an opportune time to try to remedy that and try to provide programs that are of high quality, that benefit kids. You don't want to squander that opportunity. So we wanted to really dig in and see what the features of quality programs were.
For some of the more, I'll use air quotes here, vintage people among us, summer school meant that you fail a class during the year, you will do summer school and you will repeat that class. Very punitive and not seen as anything a kid would ever want to do voluntarily. How have summer learning programs evolved since, let's say, the 60s in both mission and content?
Well, there are still those kinds of summer school programs around. There are plenty of kids who still experience that.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition to those, there are new kinds of summer learning programs that attempt to both provide that academic remediation or catch up or allow for an opportunity to pass a course that the child did not pass during the school year and make it more fun and engaging. So, for example, a student might have math and reading in the morning after a healthy breakfast, and then they would have lunch. And in the afternoon, they might be engaging in activities like kayaking or sailing or water polo or bike riding, something that, you know, builds other kinds of skills and interests that is paired with the academic content offered in the morning.
Ideally, how many hours, how many days a week should a student be going?
Well, it really depends on the goals of the program. If the goals are academic in nature, which those are the kinds of programs I know the most about. So if a school district is putting on a program, for example, and they want the kids to come back to school in the fall better prepared in reading and or in math, the program itself should be offered for at least 5 weeks. We've studied these programs in cities across the country and for multiple years, and we see that kids tend to attend them 70-75% of the time, and we really see a threshold in terms of learning time. If they're not getting around 25 to 35 hours of academics, they're not benefiting, and that's not surprising. It takes time to work on reading comprehension or whatever the skill is students are focusing on during the summer.
Broadly speaking, Catherine, how accessible are summer learning programs to low-income students, special ed students? Are those students less likely to have access to summer programs than more affluent students?
Well, in terms of just programs out there in the ether, absolutely. A lot of fancy camps and other kinds of summer programs have fees associated with them. We know from census data and from research coming out of Pew that low-income children are more likely to be at home during the summer. They're even less likely to be playing outdoors. You know, these kinds of programs that school districts are developing, the kinds of programs we studied, are accessible to low-income families and students with IEPs. They tend to be free, with free transportation and free meals. Now, that doesn't mean that they're not expensive to put on, but in general, you know, during the summer, low-income kids are less active in these kinds of summer programs.
What are the important things that you've found districts can do to make summer learning programs more accessible?
Advertise them early. Parents often start thinking about summer right around the spring break time period. So if the school district has a program that's planned by then and has, you know, brochures about it and is even talking to the kids in class during the school day, or the principal is talking to parents during drop-off and pickup time, building that awareness, talking to parents about how their summer program can help their children not only come to school prepared the next school year, but also what fun things their child will be able to experience during the summer. Getting the word out early helps to, you know, increase access and take up in these programs.
And I know you were a contributing author to the 2018 RAND book, Getting to Work on Summer Learning, Recommended Practices for Success. And I did see a point that districts need to really be intentional with regard to kind of the climate of the site, because if it's going to be more enjoyable, kids are going to show up.
Exactly. Yeah, that was an interesting finding. We had a measure of the climate of the site, so the extent to which it was warm and welcoming, the extent to which the kids appeared to be having a good day and then reported to us in surveys that they were indeed having a good day. The extent to which the sites had those characteristics, there was higher student attendance in them. And as I said earlier, students need to attend in order to benefit. Now, you could argue that having a warm and welcoming environment is important in and of itself, and I would agree with that. It just also turns out that, not surprisingly, that's, you know, if that's the case, that's where kids want to be.
Certainly. And as you talk about offering a menu of things where you're maybe doing academics in the morning and then getting them outside and doing the more fun social things in the afternoon.
Right. And Michigan's a great place for that. In the summer programs we were studying in Boston, for example, the programs were held in outdoor locations. So there was one on a nature preserve. There was actually one on an island. And so the kids would do their academics still with a certified teacher, but they were doing them in these outdoor settings.
Catherine, would we just be better off having kids go to school year-round, you know, working in those breaks between semesters, but not taking the whole summer off?
Well, there are certainly advantages to that kind of model. I know that many working parents would prefer that. So there are pros and cons. Mm-hmm. One reason to not move toward that kind of a model is low-income kids tend to be disadvantaged, and in many school districts across the country, there are mixes of kids. And so if you can use the summertime to really dig in with kids who wouldn't have that kind of opportunity otherwise and are not doing well in school, it's time well spent. You know, we've interviewed teachers who have said, you know, this has been a great experience because I got to interact with, say, Johnny, who during the school year, he's very quiet and doesn't get in trouble, but he's not performing well, and he tends to get overlooked. So summer can be a way to try to narrow disparities and gaps in achievement as well as in opportunity to activities.
Catherine Augustine's a senior policy researcher for the RAND Corporation. She directs the RAND Pittsburgh office. And we want to thank you so much for sharing your work and your research with us, Catherine.
You're welcome, Cynthia.
Tomorrow on Stateside, we'll look at one summer learning program going on in West Michigan and how summer learning can make a difference in the students' academic progress. That's our show for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.